only true friendship. In 2007, researchers at the University of Michigan looked at married people aged 22 to 79 who said they had close friends. Having at least two, meaning at least one not being the spouse, was associated with higher levels of life satisfaction, self-esteem, and lower levels of depression. For those who can't name two, the spousal relationship was much more important for meeting emotional needs, and this can lead to problems. It's a lot of pressure on a marriage to fill almost every emotional role and makes rough patches in a marriage all the more catastrophic and isolating. My father's only true close friend was my mother. He was an introvert, and intimate friendships came with great difficulty, so this was the path of least resistance. And they had a good marriage. Their wedding came 4 days after they graduated from college and lasted 44 years until his death at age 66. But having your spouse or partner as your one and only close friend is imprudent, like having a radically undiversified investment portfolio. If something goes wrong in your marriage, you can be left single and without friends. That is often the case when a couple divorces or when a spouse dies. Many older adults figure this out as they age and build a non-spouse friend network. This is especially true for women who have larger, denser, and more supportive friend networks than men. And they are very gender-sorted networks. Apart from their husbands, older women rarely even consider men as their friends. Only a fifth of older women name a male friend in their list of intimates. All this is important for older men to understand if they find their wives turning outward for friendship. Marriage bonds are more emotionally important to men as they age than they are to older women because, for many men, work has crowded out friendships, and those they have are more focused on, say, golf than feelings. Their wives have invested elsewhere for emotional support, which frankly is prudent and wise. Some people assume that as they age, their intimate relationships will be built around their adult children. After all, these are the relationships in which we have invested the most, literally and figuratively. They know us, and we know them. I look at my kids, and it is like looking into my own 20-something soul. Shouldn't they be my best friends as I age? Probably not. I find that most of the conflict I have with my adult kids stems from my own poor memory of my relationship with my own parents. They were good parents, but I wanted my independence. It was important to me to have a certain amount of separation, not from bitterness, but because I wanted to build my own life. And so it is with my kids. Our relationship is great, but they're focused on their lives, not mine, as they should be. For this reason, the research finds that contact with unrelated friends is more strongly correlated with well-being than contact with adult children. As two scholars on friendship put it, interaction with family members is often dictated by obligation, whereas interaction with friends is primarily motivated by pleasure. Do you have real friends or deal friends? I remember years ago, I was on a fishing trip with my son Carlos in Florida. He was 12 or 13 years old, and the trip was his Christmas present. He asked for the same thing every year, a trip to Florida to hunt and fish, just the two of us. We did it every year for a decade until he joined the Marines, and he promises we will start doing it again when he leaves the military, as my Christmas present. We were just setting out on Lake Okeechobee one Saturday morning to catch some largemouth bass when my mobile phone rang. I checked the caller ID and saw it was the head of a large foundation with which I was doing a deal in my capacity as president of my nonprofit organization. "I have to take this," I told Carlos, and sat in the car talking to the other man. The first 5 minutes were small talk about his family and mine, even though we weren't personally close. Then we got down to business. After I hung up, Carlos asked who that was. "A friend," I answered, which was technically true. We liked each other well enough and were on a first-name basis. I had had dinner with him socially once. Carlos looked at me with a look he always gives me when he thinks I'm full of it. "A real friend or a deal friend?" he asked. Clever boy. I stopped short. He was on the money, of course. Our kids know us shockingly well. But I asked him what he meant anyway. "You don't have very many real friends," he said. "You know lots of important people, though, and you do each other favors. Those are deal friends, not real friends." Without being aware of it, Carlos was making a distinction in relationships that Aristotle had made more than 2,000 years earlier in his Nicomachean Ethics. Aristotle wrote that there is a kind of friendship ladder from lowest to highest. At the bottom, where emotional bonds are weakest and the benefits are lowest, are friendships based on utility. Deal friends, to use Carlos's coinage. You are friends in an instrumental way, one that helps each of you achieve something else you want, such as professional success. Higher up are friends based on pleasure. You are friends because of something you like and admire about the other person. They're entertaining or funny or beautiful or smart, for example. In other words, you like an inherent quality, which makes it more elevated than a friendship of utility, but it is still basically instrumental. At the highest level is Aristotle's perfect friendship, which is based on willing each other's well-being and a shared love for something good and virtuous that is outside either of you. This might be a friendship forged around religious beliefs or passion for a social cause. What it isn't is utilitarian. The other person shares in your passion, which is intrinsic, not instrumental. Of course, our friendships can be a blend. I can have a business partner whom I admire and who strongly shares my love for something good and virtuous. But I've found that in most cases, I can in fact classify my friendships pretty well into Aristotle's three baskets, and my utility basket tends to be fullest. Carlos's question made me reflect on the fact that, like a lot of hardworking, ambitious people, I had lots and lots of deal friends, but not too many real friends, and I was pretty lonely as a result. I vowed to cultivate my few real friendships much more. And what about you? Do you have real friends or just deal friends? It matters a lot for your happiness. In 2018, researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, fielded a survey about loneliness, in which they asked how often people feel like no one knows them well. 54% say they feel that way always or sometimes. Does this include you? Before you answer, name two or three real friends. If you're married, take out your spouse. Now be honest. When was the last time you talked to each of these real friends in depth? Would you be comfortable calling them if you were in trouble? If you struggled to name two or three, there's a problem. And if you haven't talked to them in a few months, or wouldn't call them in a crisis, you're most likely mixing up real friends with deal friends. Not that you're being untruthful, you might simply not have cultivated real friendships in a long, long time. Building real friendships can be tricky for people who haven't done so for many years, maybe since childhood. Researchers find it is often harder for men than women. Furthermore, women generally base friendships on social and emotional support, whereas men are more likely to base friendships on shared activities, including work. In other words, women have more real friends, men have more deal friends. This matters a lot for well-being, especially later in life. Numerous studies have shown that one of the great markers for happiness among people at midlife and beyond is people who can rattle off the names of a few authentic close friends. It is not necessary that they be numerous to achieve happiness, and in fact, people tend to get more selective about their friends as they age and reduce the number of true intimates. But the number of real friends needs to be more than zero and more than just your spouse. Recognizing these patterns, I resolved to make closer friends, and my wife vowed to collaborate. This is not easy for anyone, and especially hard for me because we've moved a lot, so my friendships where I live don't have roots that go back years. So we devised a plan. We started organizing our social life specifically around conversations about profound issues. At the risk of becoming Mr. and Mrs. Intense, we directed dinnertime chats with friends away from trivialities like vacation plans and house purchases and toward issues of happiness, love, and spirituality. This deepened some of our friendships, and in other cases showed us that a more fulfilling relationship wasn't going to be possible, and thus, where to put less energy. The barriers to love. Here's the bottom line summary about your relationships, the key points for cultivating your Aspen Grove. You need strong human connections to help you get on the second curve and flourish. No matter how introverted you are, you cannot expect to thrive into old age without healthy, intimate relationships. For married people, a loving, companionate spousal relationship is key to thriving. Marriage and family are not an adequate substitute for close friendships, which should not be left up to chance. Friendship is a skill that requires practice, time, and commitment. Work friendships are not a substitute for real friendships, although they can also be satisfying if designed purposefully. In my interviews and conversations over the past several years, I find a surprising amount of resistance to this information and the advice to start building relationships immediately. Here are three things people often tell me. First, I just don't have time. Love and friendships are enormously time-consuming. It's true. They crowd out all kinds of other things like, well, let's be honest, for many listeners to this book, they mostly crowd out work. If that's the case for you, and it's what's holding back the proper development of romance, parenting, and real friendships, you have your priorities unbalanced. Remember, a classic sign of addictive behavior is when something not human starts to supplant human relationships, hence the term workaholism, which we discussed earlier. The all-consuming need to work, achieve, earn, and succeed. If you're displaying workaholic behavior, no amount of advice about making friends will help. You will never have time or energy left for close relationships. You need to address the workaholism problem before anything else. Acknowledging this truth requires facing what the workaholic is avoiding with the extra hour of work. If it is dysfunctional relationships themselves, possibly brought on by years of neglect, it will only get worse by indulging the addiction. It is worth remembering that the cliche image of an old man on his deathbed saying to his family, "I wish I'd spent more time at work," is a joke. To escape his addiction, the workaholic has to reapportion time and use it to establish or reestablish friendships and family life. This leads to the second lament I often hear once the problem has been acknowledged. My relationships are so withered, I don't know where to start. Some have gone many years without cultivating close relationships with others. The ties with family members and friends are not the only problem after years of neglect, however. Arguably, a bigger problem is that closeness requires practice. You can basically lose your love chops if you neglect them for a long time. If that describes you, you will need to reawaken your dormant relationship skills. The first step is articulating your desire for deeper connections. This signals to others your commitment to change, but more important, it signals this commitment to yourself. Often, change is just an idea in our heads until we say it out loud. I've known people who have been thinking about a life change for decades. Thinking about working less and spending more time with family and friends isn't worth much, but telling your loved ones you want this will program the ideas into your brain and set you toward meeting this goal. But how do you get started when you've lost your skills? Is a 65-year-old businessman just supposed to call another guy and suggest a play date? Ridiculous! Actually, maybe not so ridiculous. I remember when my kids were really little, we would get them together with other children. They wouldn't exactly play together. They would do something child development experts call parallel play. The kids play with their own toys individually, but next to each other. This is part of their process of acquiring friendship skills. Little by little, they start interacting more, until over the months that pass, they wind up playing together with the same toys. There's a new phenomenon emerging in several countries, including the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia, called men's sheds. It is basically parallel play for older men who are relearning friendship skills. Men who are lonely, many retired but not all, are left by their loved ones in, well, sheds full of woodworking tools where they can work on crafts projects in parallel with other men. Remember, men tend to develop friendships in the course of shared activities, and these crafts allow this while not requiring direct collaboration. Parallel play. Little by little, the men begin to interact with one another, rebuilding friendship skills as they make new friends. "I come here, I chat with people, and I feel like I accomplished something," one man told a Washington Post reporter while working on a football-shaped trophy for a friend. "I was nervous at first, but people were really welcoming, and now I come here at least once a week." It doesn't really matter if it's sheds or something else. And for women who need to rebuild relationships, perhaps it's something else entirely. The point is that to kindle friendships requires acts, not intentions. The third objection I hear is this: I doubt people would forgive me. In some cases, withered relationships feature a lot of ill will on the part of the loved ones. Marriages have turned sour over decades of neglect, and the connections with adult children are ice cold. Success addicts are often the object of tremendous resentment from people who needed and deserved their love and attention, but did not receive it for many years. It's time to make amends. Success addicts can learn a thing or two about recovery from alcoholics. Those who have followed the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous know that recovery is not possible without step 9. Make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Alcoholics in recovery make a list of people they have hurt and neglected due to their addiction. They must make amends with each person on the list, if possible. This is complicated, obviously. "Sorry I wrecked your car that night when I was drunk" might not heal a wound immediately or adequately. But it's a good start, especially when backed up by a commitment to refrain from drinking and repay the debt. And so it is for the victims of a success addiction. "Sorry about choosing tedious board meetings," which I don't even remember now, "over your ballet recitals," probably won't fix everything. It has to be accompanied by new behavior. With relationships, actions speak louder than words, especially if your words have been fairly empty in the past. Measuring your life. Earlier in this book, I mentioned a question I ask my students to get their attention. How many Thanksgivings do you have left? The truth is that it gets my attention as well. If I follow suit with my parents, it's probably like 8. We Brookses die fairly young. The point isn't to depress anybody. It's to remind us that in denominating time in memorable, scarce events, we have a much better sense of its scarcity. Thus, we use it more wisely. This is the same idea as saying that we should live each day as if it were our last. If we followed this insight, we would probably sort out our workaholism and success addiction problems. The cognitive error that feeds them is the idea that our time is limitless, so the marginal decision, what to do with the next hour, is not very important in the broad scheme of things. We come face to face with this error when time is up and it's too late. This is what business management consultants might call a systematic measurement error. In that spirit, I've adopted the work of a business expert for an exercise to help me solve it in my life. The expert is the late Clayton Christensen, a longtime professor at the Harvard Business School, where I serve on the faculty. Christensen died a few months after I arrived at Harvard, but his legacy looms large at HBS, in no small part because of his famous book, How Will You Measure Your Life? Christensen analyzes a good life well lived in the same way he would assess a company, and the book is well worth reading in its entirety. However, one section provided me with the material for a 3-part exercise for avoiding the snares of workaholism and success addiction while investing in the relationships that bring true satisfaction. Number 1, allocate time well ahead of time. Successful people are good at marginal thinking, making sure each hour is spent on its best use at that moment. The trouble is that this always marginalizes the things in life that don't have a clear payoff in the short run, like relationships. This is why an extra hour of work, even when we are exhausted and unproductive, can crowd out the first hour at home, day after day, year after year, leading to the problems of loneliness and alienation. To avoid this error, I take 1 hour Sunday afternoon each month and start by imagining myself at the end of my life, surrounded by the people I love. I think about what they're saying about me. Then I come back to the present. I think about how I want to allocate my time in the coming weeks. What do I want to do with my time this week to cultivate the relationships that will result in that end scenario? I might make the decision to leave work on time, leave my work at the office, get home for dinner, and watch a movie after dinner with my family. Number 2, do your core job. Many businesses fail because of what we might call the Edsel problem, based on the famous 1958 car that Ford executives loved but that consumers hated. They sell what they like rather than what the consumer wants and needs. We can be like this in our relationships, especially when our competence has diminished after years of neglect. We give our families and friends the opportunity to spend time at our convenience doing what is interesting to us. And it makes sense. If I'm the king at work, I'm the king at home. It doesn't work this way, of course. Love relationships are not hierarchical, but reciprocal. They require giving what people want and need, not that which is most convenient to the giver. I regularly write out a list of the people with whom I need a stronger relationship. Then I list next to each of them what they need from me that only I can provide. For example, there are things that only I can do for my wife. There are some things only I can do for my adult children. When those things are neglected, relationships starve. Number 3, invest intelligently. Once, when one of my sons was in high school, he asked me the 3 things I really wanted for him in life. I thought about it for a few days, and my own answer surprised me. I didn't say happiness, because while that's important, a good life of purpose and meaning also requires unhappiness. I certainly didn't say money or fame, as you can already predict. In the end, I told him, honesty, compassion, and faith. That's what I felt would make him the best man he could become. After that, I decided to write down the 3 things I want for each of the people I love the most and then ask, am I investing in those things in their lives? Am I putting my time, energy, affection, expertise, and money toward the development of these assets and qualities? Am I modeling them with my own behavior? Do I need a new investment strategy? The payoff. In 2009, researchers at the University of Rochester published a study in which they recruited 147 recent university graduates and asked them their goals after graduation. They found that goals fell into 2 basic categories, which they called intrinsic and extrinsic. Intrinsic goals centered around fulfillment from deep, enduring relationships. Extrinsic goals centered on earning a lot of money, owning a lot of stuff, gaining power, or achieving reputation and fame. In other words, the wants that make up the denominator of the satisfaction equation. This is the stuff to toss out of the bucket. The scholars followed up a year later to find out how the participants were doing. To begin with, people generally achieved their goals. Those who wanted great relationships had them, while those who wanted money and power were on track to get those things. This is a pretty important finding. You're probably going to get what you wish for in life. This makes it all the more true, as the old saying goes, to be careful what you wish for. The second finding is the really profound one, though. People with intrinsic goals had happier lives after a year. Meanwhile, the people who pursued extrinsic goals experienced more negative emotions, such as shame and fear. They also suffered more physical maladies. In a nutshell, if your life goals revolve around lots of money, prestige, and other worldly things, you're setting yourself up to have exploding wants and low life satisfaction. You kind of knew this, didn't you? Perhaps you've been a full-on extrinsic goals junkie for many years and have fed your addiction all the way up your fluid intelligence curve. But if you're mature and experienced in the ways of life, another way of saying you're getting up there in years like me, you now know that extrinsic rewards are foolish goals. But it is precisely this knowledge that leads us to the frustrations of life. In your youth, you hold out hope that these haves will finally satisfy. As the years pass, you learn that they never do. But your habits are so ingrained, and you're so skilled at chasing the old rewards. You pursue a fading hope that if you finally have this or achieve that worldly goal, you'll finally achieve the satisfaction you seek. This is an exercise in futility and leaves you stuck on your declining fluid intelligence curve, the only place you know to look for rewards. Only a shift to intrinsic goals will give you what you really want and prepare you to get on the second curve, which requires relationships and sharing wisdom in the spirit of love. But can you get new goals, especially later in life? Indeed, you can, but you need to state your intrinsic values more openly. Here's a trick to get started on this. Visualize yourself at a party. Someone asks, "What do?" You answer not with extrinsic stuff like your job title, but with what you know will give you the most purpose, meaning, and joy. Involve your spiritual life, your relationships, and the way you serve others. Don't imagine yourself saying, "I'm a lawyer." Imagine yourself saying instead, "I'm a wife and a mother to 3 adult kids." Don't worry if you don't quite believe it yourself at first, that this is who you truly are and what you do. You will speak this truth into existence in your life. It's difficult to describe adequately the depth of the rewards that one enjoys when relationships become your official source of meaning and fulfillment. People compare it with finding buried treasure, with the only sadness being that it didn't happen earlier in life. Writers elegize the bliss of love and friendship. As Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote in his joyful essay, Friendship, "I awoke this morning with devout thanksgiving for my friends, the old and the new. Shall I not call God the beautiful, who daily showeth himself so to me in his gifts? I chide society, I embrace solitude, and yet I am not so ungrateful as not to see the wise, the lovely, and the noble-minded, as from time to time they pass my gate. Who hears me, who understands me, becomes mine, a possession for all time." An intimate friendship, whether it be from the companionate love of your spouse or an Aristotelian perfect friend, is better than any professional success. It will salve the wounds of professional decline like nothing else. Consider J.S. Bach, whom we met earlier. He loved his work and enjoyed his early success, but he knew what mattered most. You don't become the loving father of 20 kids without significant investment, and the well-documented warm relationships he had with both his wives and their surviving children indicate this investment was enormous. He loved them, and they loved him. Bach's work and life were balanced in part by blurring the line where one started and the other stopped. His two-part inventions and symphonias were written as exercises for their musical studies. His second wife was his copyist. He was a major promoter of his children's musical careers. The reason Bach died a happy man was not because of his success as a composer, which had decreased greatly over the last decades of his life. It was because of the relationships he had cultivated, which became the animating force behind his own professional change from compositional innovator to master teacher. Taking love even higher. I thought I was having a truly original insight that day under the aspen tree. But of course, many have seen this before me. The most notable is probably Henry David Thoreau, who wrote, "Two sturdy oaks, I mean, which side by side withstand the winter storm, and spite of wind and tide grow up the meadow's pride, for both are strong. Above they barely touch, but undermine down to their deepest source. Admiring you shall find their roots are intertwined inseparably." There is something inherently transcendent about relationships and the magical way they elevate us from our material drudgery if we let them. Strivers have an incredible opportunity to pivot from struggling against the tide of professional decline toward the wellspring of joy that is the love of others as they move from the first to the second curve. In truth, English is an impoverished language when it comes to love. In Greek, for example, there are several distinct words for love. Philia, the love between friends. Eros, romantic love. Storgia, the love by parents of children. Philautia, self-love, and xenia, hospitality or love of the stranger. But the most transcendent of all the Greek concepts of love is agape, the love of man for the divine. It was regarded as the highest, most beatific kind of love. To achieve it is a kind of ecstasy. It doesn't come naturally to many strivers, however, who've put their faith for so long in themselves and the world's rewards. Our next lesson is how all of us can attain it, no matter where we are in our life's journey, and how it can give us the confidence to move forward with our lives. Chapter 7. Start Your Vanaprastha. It was a sticky, humid morning in February 2018 when I set off deep into the South Indian countryside. My destination was a small town called Palakkad, on the border between the states of Kerala and Tamil Nadu. I should back up a bit. For years, since stumbling across the Hindu guru Paramahansa Yogananda's writings as a young man, I was aware of an ancient Indian theory of the ashramas, about how to transition through middle age in happiness and enlightenment. I didn't know much more than that, though. I Googled around for it, looked for books in English, and asked Indian friends for details, but never found much of any depth. This isn't too surprising, actually. A huge amount of deep Hindu philosophy has resisted the globalization of ideas and information. I had been told that to find what I was seeking, I needed to find a teacher. Not that this search presented a hardship for me, mind you. For years, I have been an Indiaphile. Since my first visit at age 19, I have loved the culture, the music, the food, the philosophy, and especially the Indians themselves. Between their sense of humor and easy spirituality, I always feel completely at home. I find an excuse to visit every year at least once, and I have sat at the feet of many a spiritual teacher on the subcontinent. On that morning in 2018, I rose at 4 a.m. and traveled several hours by car to a small, unmarked home where I hoped to meet the guru Sri Nochir Venkataraman. I had it on good authority that Venkataraman, known simply as Acharya, or teacher, to his disciples, could explain to me the ashramas, and more specifically, who I should be looking to be as I head into the back half of my life. Obtaining a meeting with Acharya was no mean feat. Unlike many of the wealth and fame-seeking guru entrepreneurs in India, Acharya is not rich, seeks no media presence, and has never been to the West. He's a quiet, humble man dedicated to helping people attain spiritual growth. He has no interest in techies looking for clarity about a new startup idea or Western dilettantes running away from their own religion. But with some cajoling, I convinced his retinue that I was neither shopping for a new faith nor out to make money. The meeting was a scene made for television, although there were no cameras. I removed my sandals and entered the unremarkable home, where I found the guru surrounded by a circle of silent devotees. He made the traditional namaste greeting with his hands and said, "I've been waiting for you." We sat, and I was immediately filled with a complete sense of peace. For a few minutes, I forgot why I was there. Recovering my focus, I told Acharya I had come in search of how to live life in its proper stages. Many people suffer as they age because they lose their abilities, gained over many years of hard work. Moving to a new stage of life is hard, even frightening. I had heard that he could give me insights into these matters. Over the next 2 hours, Acharya explained the ancient Indian teaching that a proper life must be lived in four stages. These are the ashramas. Ideally, ashramas last 25 years each. Of course, that is generally not likely to occur. In America today, the odds of living to 100 are only about 1 in 6,000. The odds are lower in India. But the deeper point of the wisdom is not to make it to 100 and break life into equal parts. It's to spend significant time in each distinct stage. The first ashrama is Brahmacharya, the period of youth and young adulthood dedicated to learning. The second is Grihastha, when a person builds a career, accumulates wealth, and maintains a family. The second stage seems fairly straightforward and uncontroversial, but in this stage, the Hindu philosophers find one of life's most common traps. People become attached to its earthly rewards, money, power, sex, prestige, and thus try to make this stage last a lifetime. Sound familiar? This is another description of being stuck on the fluid intelligence curve, chasing Aquinas's four idols, money, power, pleasure, and honor, that lead to self-objectification, but that never satisfy. To break the attachment to these idols requires movement to a new stage of life with a new set of skills, spiritual skills. The change can be painful, Acharya said, like becoming an adult for a second time, and it means letting go of things that defined us in the eyes of the world. In other words, we have to move beyond the worldly rewards to experience transition and find wisdom in a new ashrama, and so defeat the scourge of attachments. That ordinarily occurs if we are diligent around age 50. And that new stage? It's called vanaprastha, which comes from two Sanskrit words meaning retiring and into the forest. This is the stage at which we purposefully begin to pull back from our old personal and professional duties, becoming more and more devoted to spirituality and deep wisdom, crystallized intelligence, teaching, and faith. It does not mean the perfect life requires retiring at age 50 into a forest. Rather, that one's life goals must readjust. Vanaprastha is the metaphysical context of the second curve. But vanaprastha isn't the last stop, Acharya told me. That would be sannyasa, the last spiritual stage that comes in old age. This is the stage totally dedicated to the fruits of enlightenment. In times past, some Hindu men would literally leave their families at around age 75, take holy vows, and spend the rest of their lives at the feet of masters, praying and studying the holy scriptures. In Acharya's words, the moment you realize the self, you know that you are the self, you are not the body, you know that you are the infinite truth. That recognition, that realization is sannyasa. Even if sitting in a cave at age 75 isn't your cup of tea, the point should still be clear. The goal of the last phase of life is to drink from the chalice of life's deepest secrets. To be able to do that requires study and work on philosophical and theological matters, which happens in the years of vanaprastha. You can't just show up and expect to be enlightened. That would be like showing up to the Olympics without ever having trained as an athlete. I think this is something we intuitively understand, that as we mature, we should seek spiritual growth in anticipation of an old age filled with enlightenment. That's why so many are pulled to their old faith, a new faith, a deepened faith, or a renewed faith. But some resist these changes with all their might. In raging against decline and denying the realities of change, they also block out their need for the metaphysical. They live their last decades looking out the back window of the car, anxiously watching the glorious past recede and unwilling to look into the future with its new promises and transcendent adventures. Like the man on the plane. I told Acharya about that man. He listened carefully and thought for a minute. He failed to leave Grihastha, he told me. He was addicted to the rewards of the world. He explained that the man's self-worth was probably still derived from the memories of professional successes many years earlier, and despite his ongoing recognition, it was purely derivative of long-lost skills. Any glory today was a mere shadow of the glories of the past. Meanwhile, he completely skipped the spiritual development of vanaprastha and was now missing out on the bliss of sannyasa. This provides a roadmap for those of us suffering from the principle of psychoprofessional gravitation. Say you're a hard-charging lawyer, journalist, type A CEO, or, as I was at the time I met Acharya, president of a think tank. From early adulthood to middle age, your foot is on the gas professionally. You seek the worldly rewards of success. You achieve some, or a lot of them, and you may be deeply attached to these rewards. But you must be prepared to walk away from these achievements and rewards before you feel ready. The decline in your fluid intelligence is a sign that it is not time to rage, which just doubles down on your unsatisfying attachments and leads to frustration. Rather, it's time to scale up your crystallized intelligence, use your wisdom, and share it with others. I asked Acharya, what is the one piece of advice he would give men and women my age who have been workaholics and success addicts, special, not happy, and who tremble at the idea of leaving Grihastha? He paused for a long time. Know yourself, he finally said. That is all. Nothing else. Nothing else can release. How? I asked. By going within, he replied. When your mind is quieter, you will find that treasure waiting for you within. Faith rises as we age. Many people find that in a midlife transitional state, their interest in religion and spirituality unexpectedly increases. Faith, religion, spirituality, or perhaps just an interest in the transcendent, commonly grows in our hearts as we move into middle adulthood. Perhaps this seems odd to you, because people often become more skeptical of magical things. Nobody over 10, let alone 40, believes in the Easter Bunny, but it is strikingly common to find religious yearnings creeping in during one's 40s and 50s or later. For many, the metaphysical begins to feel real as we get older, and changes to ourselves are occurring that we can't explain. The theologian James Fowler explained this pattern in his famous 1981 book, Stages of Faith. After studying hundreds of human subjects, Fowler observed that as young adults, many people are put off by ideas that seem arbitrary or morally retrograde, such as those surrounding sexuality. They may also become disillusioned by religion's inability to explain life's hardest puzzles. For example, the idea of a loving God in the face of a world full of suffering. As they get older, however, people begin to recognize that nothing is tidy in life. This, according to Fowler, is when they become tolerant of religion's ambiguities and inconsistencies and start to see the beauty and transcendence in faith and spirituality, either their own faith from childhood or some other. Fowler's later research asked whether the stages he found in the 1970s and 1980s held with modern developments, such as falling religious participation in the United States. He observed that they did. Strivers, however, are often the least prepared for this change because many have made little or no investment in this area of life. On the way up, professionally, faith and spirituality might be nice to have, but not any kind of priority, so they languish. For those who embrace faith at this stage, however, it is a joyful epiphany. Mountains of research show that religious and spiritual adults are generally happier and generally suffer less depression than those who have no faith. And the benefits of finding faith as an adult go beyond life satisfaction, according to research on the subject. Religion and spirituality are also linked to better physical health. This could be in part because the majority of studies find practitioners are less likely than others to abuse drugs and alcohol. Researchers sometimes half-heartedly speculate on why this is so, pointing to healthy lifestyles or increased social interaction when people attend religious services. After many years in this field, I believe these things are true. But the best explanation for the happiness bump is far simpler than these roundabout benefits. When you spend serious time and effort focused on transcendental things, it puts your little world into proper context and takes the focus off yourself. Most of our days, I'm thinking me, me, me. It's like watching the same dreary television show over and over all day long. It's so boring. Faith forces me into the cosmos to consider the source of truth, the origin of life, and the good of others. This focus brings refreshment and relief. A common question I get is whether this higher focus must be religious or spiritual. Can it be, say, an interest in philosophy? To this, the answer is yes. A perfect example is the growing interest today among young people in ancient Greek thinking, specifically Epicurean and Stoic philosophy. Many in the last few years have taken a keen interest in the works of Epicurus, Epictetus, Seneca, and Marcus Aurelius. And not for intellectual reasons. They find secrets to the meaning of their lives therein, and it brings them happiness. The bottom line, if you're in a transitional state in your life and find your interest in the transcendental growing, even if you have marginalized this part of your life in the past, you're right on schedule. Don't resist. My faith and my guru. Religion and spirituality are touchy subjects. They're personal and sometimes controversial. There's a reason why so many social clubs ban the discussion of politics and religion. Disagreements have ended friendships and started wars. Discussions of religion are fraught with mistrust because it often feels like someone is trying to sell you a Buick, to proselytize instead of giving questions and ideas fair and open treatment. I debated leaving out this chapter. There's no real way to get around these problems completely, but it helps when your interlocutor in a conversation about faith lays her or his cards on the table. You can assess arguments better when at least you know where someone's coming from. That way, agendas are harder to hide. In that spirit, let me tell you about my own faith journey. I'm a Roman Catholic convert, having come into the church as a teenager after being raised in an observant Protestant home. My Christian faith was central to my parents' lives, and it is central to my life as well, even though I practice it in a different way than they did. My spiritual inspirations come from all over the place, from my study of other religions, to my love of mathematics, to the music of J.S. Bach, whom I profiled a few chapters ago as the sine qua non of jumping from fluid to crystallized intelligence. I also take inspiration from Bach's faith itself. His career adaptation was not the most salient aspect of his personal story. Rather, it was his relationship with God. The Bach Family Bible was dog-eared from his daily reading, its margins full of his notes of thanks and praise. He finished each of his scores with the words Soli Deo Gloria, glory to God alone. He believed every note he wrote was sanctified and divinely inspired. "I play the notes as they are written," he said, "but it is God who makes the music." When asked why he wrote music, his answer was simple but profound. "The aim and final end of all music should be none other than the glory of God and the refreshment of the soul." I wanted to answer like Bach about my own work, to sanctify it to the glory of God and the service of others. Indeed, this is one of the reasons I moved from music to social science, as absurd as that might sound. My wife's path to faith was different. She was raised in ultra-secular Barcelona. If you're thinking, "But Spain is a very religious place," your views are out of date. Spain today is effectively a post-Christian country. Think Denmark. She hadn't attended Mass more than a few times in her entire life. She was not religious, and in fact, pretty hostile to religions of all varieties, especially Catholicism. After marrying, I went to church, but my wife did not accompany me. When our kids were born, I took them with me on Sunday mornings while she got a break and slept in. It went on like this for a long time, and it was a source of sadness for me. I had nearly given up on the idea that she might find her own faith when, suddenly it seemed to me, an interest in Catholic spirituality sprang up in her. I don't really know what happened. Over the following decade, her faith grew as she practiced, studied, and learned. It became the center of her life, and she became the more religiously adept of the two of us. And then, when I started this project several years ago, I felt a pull to inflect my own faith upward, to get more serious about what I believe. That was the motivating factor behind my sojourn into the southern Indian countryside in 2018. Acharya's lessons about Vanaprastha greatly expanded my consciousness, connecting my spiritual journey, the crystallized intelligence curve, and chipping things away. I told Acharya about Esther, how we met 30 years ago when I was on a chamber music tour in Europe, how I believed I fell in love after just a couple of hours, even though we didn't speak a word of the same language, how I quit my job in New York and moved to Barcelona in a bid to convince her to marry me. Acharya asked about her faith life. I told him the truth. She came late to it, but now Esther leads me down the path of righteousness. She teaches me scripture. She helps me in my prayers. She takes me every single day to Mass. He silently contemplated this for a moment. Then he said, matter-of-factly, "She is your guru." In the sacred Hindu text, Uddhava Gita, Lord Krishna teaches, "One who desires to adopt the third order of life, Vanaprastha, should enter the forest with a peaceful mind, leaving his wife with his mature sons." But then he adds, "or else taking her along with him." I'll take that second option. Nicodemus at Night. Developing your spiritual life can seem daunting. Some people don't know where to start. But others, after a striver's life of self-sufficiency, are reluctant even to admit they want to try. I call this latter situation the Nicodemus syndrome. Nicodemus was a Pharisee, a member of the powerful group of religious leaders called the Sanhedrin in Palestine in the early years of the Common Era. He was risking a lot when he snuck out at night to an illicit meeting, but the pull on his heart was just too strong. For days, he had thought about almost nothing else. The object of his attraction was not a mistress, but a spiritual teacher, different from any he had ever heard or met. The teacher performed signs and miracles. More to the point, he seemed to know Nicodemus intimately, despite the fact that they had only just met. "Alas, how truly he readeth what is passing in my heart," poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow imagines him saying. Nicodemus found the teacher on the dark street, waiting for him with an expression at once penetrating and peaceful. But he was silent. It was the Pharisee's moment to bare his soul. "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God," said Nicodemus, "for no one could perform the signs you are doing if God were not with him." The teacher was, of course, Jesus of Nazareth. For months, Nicodemus's fellow Pharisees had railed against Jesus for openly flouting the rules of the Sabbath and having the nerve to denounce them as hypocrites. Nicodemus should have hated him as well, but his attraction to the teacher's message of God's tender love came at a key moment in his life, a moment in which he had begun to question his long-held beliefs. When Nicodemus shows up 4 chapters later in the Gospel of St. John, we now find him in a transitional state between his old beliefs and the new ones that attract him. He's in a group of Pharisees intent on arresting Jesus for his heretical teachings. Still on the side of the establishment, Nicodemus nonetheless openly defends Jesus to his colleagues, asking them, "Our law does not judge people without first giving them a hearing to find out what they are doing, does it?" Predictably, his fellow Pharisees turn on Nicodemus. "Surely you are not also from Galilee," they ask mockingly, for Jesus' home region of Galilee is a backwater compared with cosmopolitan Jerusalem. Flyover country, you might say today. "Search and you will see that no prophet is to arise from Galilee." He is now in an awkward position. Imagine defending an unpopular Democrat at a Republican rally or vice versa, and you get a small hint of what he must have experienced. His defense of Jesus has imperiled his status, and being between the two camps simply will not do. What does he choose? We have to wait 12 more chapters to find out, but Nicodemus shows up one last time in the immediate aftermath of Jesus' execution on the cross. Unlike so many followers who scatter when the teacher is put to death, Nicodemus takes responsibility for Jesus' lifeless body, preserving it with a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. He is now clearly all in, devoted to Jesus, even after the master's death. Today, Nicodemus is a saint in the Catholic and Eastern Orthodox churches, and charmingly, the official patron saint of curiosity. No matter what your spiritual predilections, perhaps his transformation has lessons for you. Overcoming obstacles in the road. The Nicodemus syndrome is just one barrier. There are others that can cause a spiritually hungry person to turn back if he or she can't see a way around them, especially if it is all brand new. Number 1, the nun in the mirror. Nicodemus came to Jesus at night because he didn't want anyone to witness his meeting. A powerful, successful man, he was afraid to be seen questioning his established beliefs and considering something new. I often meet middle-aged people who are having religious stirrings for the first time, or at least the first time since they were young. But like Nicodemus, many find these urges confusing and even troubling, especially if they have always neglected faith as unimportant, or moved away from faith earlier in life and redefined themselves as non-religious or even anti-religious. To relax this stance makes people feel like others will find them weak or flaky. Furthermore, it can disequilibrate a person's self-concept, which is intensely uncomfortable. Psychologist Carl Rogers famously argued that we always need an answer to the question, "Who am I?" We develop our self-concept as we grow in age. Rogers defined well-balanced people as those with a self-concept that matches their life experiences. In contrast, Rogers defined a neurotic person as one who could not accept her or his experiences as valid, and thus who has a distorted self-concept. We resist any deviation from our self-concept because it provokes feelings of insecurity. This is why adolescence is so hard. Teenagers literally don't know the answer to the "who am I" question, and it makes them a little nuts. It's also why parents sometimes find them so alarmingly different when they come back home the first time from college. Adolescence isn't the only time when self-concept becomes especially fluid. Another classic self-concept crisis is when, as adults, we inexplicably begin to question our declared self as a non-religious person, or in the parlance of survey research, a nun, N-O-N-E, as a fifth of Americans classify themselves. While none might not seem like a barrier to finding faith, it's a void to be filled, right? It's actually a commitment, an identity as powerful as Jew or Buddhist. To change the self-concept as a nun is confusing and hard on one's pride. Pride freezes us in our own image, beliefs, and positions. To become unfrozen from a committed stance as a nun can be humiliating, a declaration of weakness. I have known people who, after years declaring the stupidity of religion and spirituality, wind up sneaking off to church, as if it were some sort of illicit love affair. That's Nicodemus at night. But even if none is an accurate portrayal of you at the moment, it doesn't have to hamstring your openness to religion and spirituality. The key is to subtly shift your self-concept from none to none right now, or perhaps none but open to suggestion. This injects the element of vulnerability to your understanding of yourself, which has a powerful effect. While you may not have faith right now, the door is cracked open. Something might wander in. Number two, Santa and the church. Once, when my kids were little, we drove past a local church, and my elder son, then about 4 years old, asked whether Santa Claus lived there. My wife and I found that hilarious, but it highlights a typical problem in the formation of faith. Our first impression of faith and spirituality tends to be childish, and that impression can haunt us as we mature. We often dismiss religion as a mishmash of myths and childish nonsense that well-adjusted adults should logically leave behind. Many opponents of religion attack it by appealing to these memories. For example, just before Christmas in 2010, I saw a billboard at the mouth of the Lincoln Tunnel, which takes tens of thousands of commuters from New Jersey into New York City each day, featuring the silhouette of the three kings approaching Bethlehem. The caption underneath read, "You know it's a myth. This season, celebrate reason." I will admit that I broke out laughing when I saw it, even though I'm a religious person, because it was such a clever ploy by a group opposed to all religion. But it was not an appeal to reason. Exactly the contrary. It was an appeal to us to reduce faith to a Bible story many of us heard as children and rejected outright if, as adults, it does not seem likely to be literally accurate in every detail. That's about as reasonable as divorcing your spouse because he or she doesn't live up to happily ever after fairy tales you heard as a child. It's childish. When spiritual urges arise, the appropriate course of action for adults is not to cross-reference them to naive ideas we had as children. We wouldn't do that in any other area of life. Rather, it's to look to greater minds than our own. Every major religious, spiritual, and philosophical tradition boasts a library of writers and thinkers beyond what we could apprehend in a lifetime. For example, Thomas Aquinas was an unparalleled genius, reportedly writing 25 books at once, all of them learned and erudite. His greatest work, the Magisterial Summa Theologica, is a masterpiece of philosophy and anticipated almost every serious objection to faith. If you admit your own view of childhood religion was naive, you can allow yourself to search for transcendental truths not as you first learned them, but rather from a mature, critical perspective. This requires that you emancipate yourself from the cartoon versions in your mind. Leave them behind and expose yourself with an openness to the thinking and writing of scholars and worthy practitioners. Number three, the tyranny of time. To practice faith requires time and effort. There's no getting around this. As such, it competes with the demands of our ordinary lives. You can't really contemplate the secrets of the universe in a couple of hours. That's more like a commitment to watching a movie. If you attend worship services, right there, that's a couple of hours every week. If you read, pray, or meditate and want to get something out of it, that's time every day. And these are just table stakes. Any advanced practitioner of faith or spirituality spends as much time on this as a fitness buff does at the gym, because that's what it takes to make progress. It's also what they want to do, because it's deeply gratifying. But at least at the beginning, it's a huge time imposition. As such, many people craving faith simply never find the time or never devote enough effort to develop anything meaningful. They just kick the can of faith down the road of life, and wind up saying, as one elderly friend, who has since died, confessed to me, "My one true regret is not having gotten around to my faith." The solution here is to stop seeing your spiritual development as a side interest, but rather to put it front and center. If I told you you had a serious health problem requiring that you exercise half an hour a day and take some medicine, you'd do it. Not everyone would, but you would. I know this because no one listening this far into this book is a slacker about self-development. Well, your spiritual development is that important. You must make the time by scheduling your meditation, prayer, reading, and practice every day. Walking into transcendence. For many, what's needed is simply an excuse to get started, a punctuation to the equilibrium of life that allows them to try something new. Here's a simple suggestion. Go for a walk. When I was with Acharya, my spiritual senses heightened. I noticed something I had not seen in many previous trips to India, the number of people walking on the road, deep in prayer. In some places, such as the holy city of Mathura, the city believed to be the birthplace of Lord Krishna that today boasts 5,000 temples, these praying walkers were everywhere. I asked an Indian friend about this tradition. Those are yatris, he told me, pilgrims. In the Hindu tradition, the wanderer, often a penniless mendicant, is held in reverence, and pilgrimage is considered central to spiritual awakening for ordinary people. Nearly all major religions have pilgrimages, which are, according to different definitions, the physical traversing of some distance from home to the holy place, motivated by sentiment or belief, and undertaken as an act of devotion, from the Muslim Hajj to Mecca to the Buddhist trek to Bodh Gaya, where they find the fig tree under which the Lord Buddha is said to have obtained enlightenment. And for Catholics, there is the famous Camino de Santiago, or Way of St. James, across northern Spain. Since meeting Acharya, I have walked 2-week-long portions of the Camino, navigating a different route each time through rural villages and over Roman roads to the famous Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela, where the remains of St. James the Apostle, Santiago in Spanish, are believed to be held. It has attracted millions since it was established in the 9th century. It fell into disuse in the 20th century before becoming popular because of the 2010 movie The Way, starring Martin Sheen. Since then, the Camino de Santiago has seen an explosion in the number of pilgrims, rising from 145,877 in 2009 to 347,578 in 2019. Why do they do it? For one thing, walking is excellent exercise. Indeed, it is one of the best exercises we can engage in for health and happiness. Some hope it will be an adventure, which is how it is aggressively marketed by the Spanish government. This perplexes me, because an adventure it is certainly not, unless your idea of thrill-seeking involves a monotonous, repetitive act carried out for hours a day. There is no danger besides the occasional village dog, and no huge challenge beyond the sore muscles and blisters from walking 20 kilometers per day. The secret of the Camino is, on the contrary, the utter lack of thrills. At the beginning of the journey, interior shouting torments the pilgrim, who is unaccustomed to monotony and boredom. 1,000 thoughts about life's exigencies bite at the ankles. One is tempted to stop at every roadside cafe offering Wi-Fi to check in on the outside world. But by about day 3, this begins to subside as the walk begins to harmonize the mind with the body to a pace that is natural and unforced. The walk becomes a long piece of music, and andante, of course, which neither lags nor hurries, and which brings a sense of ease. The Camino is a form of extended walking meditation, a practice in many traditions. Each mindful breath, each mindful step reminds us that we are alive on this beautiful planet, explains the Buddhist master Thich Nhat Hanh. We don't need anything else. It is wonderful enough just to be alive, to breathe in, and to make one step. The Japanese theologian Kosuke Koyama mixes the Eastern idea with his Christian faith in his book 3-Mile-an-Hour God, in which he refers to the speed we walk, and therefore it is the speed the love of God walks. The transcendent effects of a pilgrimage appear after a few days in waves of perception. Indeed, my own experiences sound almost like what others say they derive from hallucinogens. For example, I enjoy rare relief from the hedonic treadmill. The Camino is all about walking, not arriving, which lays bare the satisfaction conundrum. Fulfillment cannot come when the present moment is little more than a struggle to bear in order to attain the future, because that future is destined to become nothing more than the struggle of a new present, and the glorious end state never arrives. The focus must be on the walk that is life, with its string of present moments. Each present moment, in turn, provides small satisfactions we miss when the focus is only on bigger and better. For example, one morning, my wife and I spied the oddest flower we had ever seen, the blue passion flower, Passiflora caerulea, originally native to South America, but now contentedly at home in Galicia. Alien-looking antennae sit atop thread-like, tricolor petals, which bloom out of perfectly symmetrical leaves. We stared at it, transfixed, for 10 minutes. This would be an impossible dalliance on a typical day commuting on the hedonic treadmill, running for prizes that pale in comparison, literally, with the blue passion flower. The forced separation from ordinary ambitions temporarily right-sizes one's life. The Dalai Lama has often reminded me that I am one of 7 billion. By this, he does not mean that I am insignificant or just like everyone else. Rather, he's encouraging me to zoom out from my narrow, earthbound perspective on my life, my work, my relationships, my money. This is difficult ordinarily. It's easy on the Camino. As I walk, I envision myself as one of 7 billion people existing briefly on a timeline lasting millions of years from the past into the future. I consider the insignificance, not of my life, but of the worldly details with which I usually distract myself from metaphysical truths. I think, for example, how truly trivial it would be in the broad scheme of things if I lost my smartphone or dented my car. While the steps mark each present moment, a day is a perfect span of time to dedicate to a different intention, to focus in prayer or meditation on the good of another. One day it is personal, my son and the Marines. Another day it's global, the people of the world suffering from poverty and conflict. The walking meditation creates a sense of love and compassion for the objects of each intention and finishes with a concrete resolution to act accordingly. Finally, there's gratitude. Many have written about the so-called gratitude walk, the practice of focusing on the positive events in your life while walking, helping you to savor happiness by amplifying gratitude. I practiced this all throughout the coronavirus lockdowns around my neighborhood nightly after dinner. It was one of the sweetest memories I have of that period, and it inadvertently prepared me for my Camino in 2021. Almost the moment I began the journey, my gratitude began to bubble up for my family, faith, friends, and work, but also for a cool drink of water, taking off my shoes, and a soft pillow at night. I will be processing my Caminos for years to come. They help me understand much of the change and turbulence in my own life and position me for a vanaprastha that is fruitful. Despite my best efforts here to describe them, they're fundamentally an ineffable experience and a highly personal one as well. It's your road and yours alone, wrote the Sufi poet Rumi. Others may walk it with you, but no one can walk it for you. All I can say is that you won't be the same afterward. It will supercharge your vanaprastha. You might just walk right onto your second curve. The strength to jump. When we think of our identities as fixed and unchanging, I am this kind of person, I am not that kind of person, we're shutting ourselves off from many of life's possibilities. Being open to reevaluating our ideas about ourselves can keep us from getting stuck in patterns that aren't true to our changing selves. And what I've presented here shows that when it comes to faith, many people do change with age. Allowing that change to happen and developing our inner life helps us get on to the second curve. What so often holds people back, as in the case of Nicodemus, is that it feels like a kind of weakness to lean on spirituality after a lifetime of holding up oneself. And if there's one thing strivers hate, it's weakness. As I have shown in this chapter, however, wanting spiritual depth is not a weakness. It is a new source of strength, strength needed to jump to the crystallized intelligence curve. Spiritual longings are not just a special case of strengths looking like weaknesses. Our lives are full of these things, and that's the next lesson we need to learn to get on the second curve. Chapter 8. Make your weakness your strength. Who's the most successful entrepreneur in human history? Henry Ford? Steve Jobs, perhaps? For my money, that distinction, hands down, goes to Saul of Tarsus, later St. Paul to Christians. Even if you aren't a Christian, hear me out. He was the first century convert to the teachings of Christ, who organized the work of a messianic itinerant preacher into a body of coherent theology and spread it around the ancient world. Arguably, Paul is the inventor of Christianity as an organized religion, which has grown for 2,000 years and today has more than 2 billion followers. The iPhone's 1 billion current users isn't too shabby, I suppose. But let's just wait and see how well it's doing in the year 4000. So what was Paul's entrepreneurial secret? Here it is, in his own words from a letter to the startup Christian church in Corinth in about AD 55. "I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's